All right, open your Bible to Exodus chapter 1. Second book of the Bible, Exodus chapter 1. On this Father's Day, I want us to look at our fathers. I want us to recognize and to think about the fathers that we've had as a nation, the fathers that we have as believers in Christ. Try to remember a little bit of our past, for if we do not remember our past, as is often quoted, we will certainly are doomed to repeat the failures of it. Exodus chapter 1. Now, these are the names of the children of Israel which came into Egypt. Every man and his household came with Jacob: Reuben, Simeon, Levi, and Judah, Issachar, Zebulun, and Benjamin, Dan and Naphtali, Gad and Asher, and all the souls that came out of the loins of Jacob were 70 souls. For Joseph was in Egypt already. And Joseph died, and all his brethren, and all that generation. And the children of Israel were fruitful, and increased abundantly, and multiplied, and waxed exceeding mighty. And the land was filled with them. Now there arose up a new king over Egypt, which knew not Joseph. Joseph and his brothers were the sons of Jacob. Of course, Jacob's name was changed to Israel by Jehovah. Hence, they are called the children of Israel, and later became known simply as Israelites. Joseph and his generation was the last connection to God's chosen patriarchs of the children of Israel: Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Joseph and his generation, the last connection between the children of Israel and their patriarch forefathers. Abraham, the man of faith, the father of the faithful, the spiritual father of all believers, Jew or Gentile. Israel, the son of Abraham, the great type of Christ. Jacob, the man who wrestled with God, the father of the 12 tribes of Israel, the sinner turned saint, a great picture of saved sinners today. Joseph, the greatest Old Testament type of Christ in the Bible, the savior of the children of Israel, the protector of Egypt, the greatest example among the patriarchs of how believers should relate to civil government. I did a message series some months back, which I have yet to finish, on the 12 greatest men of the Old Testament. Joseph is absolutely one of those men, and he is one of the men that we did devote a message to. If you have not heard that series, we still have 4 men yet to finish, but Joseph has already been mentioned in the series. I would highly encourage you, if you didn't hear those messages, especially this one on Joseph, would you please go to the table afterward and tell Julie you'd like to order some of those, especially the one on Joseph. But all of them, I think, would be helpful. Those of you online, just go to the store at the top of the page, go down to the DVD section, and open up the list of all of the messages. You can go down and find it, and I hope that you'll order that. Joseph is absolutely one of the greatest men of the Bible. And here we are seeing his death and the subsequent reaction to his death. He died, and all his brethren, verse 6, and all that generation. Here's what John Gill wrote about this verse. And by the way, I mentioned his name a lot. Of course, he died in 1771, if my memory serves me correctly. But the thing you might not know or remember about him, I think I mentioned it maybe once before, John Gill was the predecessor to Charles Spurgeon. Okay, that gives you a little idea as to who this man that we're talking about and that we quote so much from was. Here's what John Gill wrote about verse 6. According to the Jewish writers, the dates of their deaths were these. Reuben lived 124 years and died 2 years after Joseph. Simeon lived 120 years and died the year after Joseph. Levi lived 137 years and died 24 years after Joseph. Judah lived 119 years, Issachar 122, Zebulun 124, and died 2 years after Joseph. Dan lived 127 years, Asher 123 years, Benjamin 111 years, and died 26 years before Levi. Gad lived 125 years and Naphtali 133 years. It is evident that they all died before the affliction and oppression of the children of Israel in Egypt began. That's why verse 6, Joseph died, his brethren, and all that generation. It is evident that they all died before the affliction and oppression of the children of Israel in Egypt began. And this account seems to be given on purpose to point this out to us, being placed in the order that it is. Levi lived the longest of them all, and the affliction did not begin until after his death. And the Jewish chronologers say that from his death to the children of Israel's going out of Egypt were 116 years. Close quote, John Gill. I hope that you remember that 116-year time frame that John Gill observes for us. 116 years of affliction and oppression. 116 years of bondage. 116 years of tyranny. 116 years of a king who knew not Joseph. Joseph was the one that led God's people to peace and prosperity in a strange land, not their own land. But he led them to peace and he led them to prosperity. Great upheaval in his own personal life did not deter him. His own brothers betrayed him. He was betrayed by a woman that he had done absolutely no harm and no wrong. He was lied about unjustly. He was thrown in prison unjustly. He spent 2 years in prison for something he didn't commit. He was a totally righteous, pure, honorable, innocent, just man. Now he's hundreds of miles from home in a strange land. He finds himself first a servant and now a prisoner. At the age of about 30, it looked like he had no future whatsoever in this world. He had no home. He had no family. He had no lover. He had no friend. He had no future. As far as he could tell, he was either going to rot in that Egyptian prison, or at some point, depending upon the will of Pharaoh, he could be taken at any time and executed. In spite of the personal cost to him, of which he counted as nothing, he rose to become the leader of all Egypt, second in power only to Pharaoh himself. Instead of wanting revenge upon his brethren who sold him as a slave to Egypt, he embraced them. He welcomed them into a land of plenty. He was the advisor to Pharaoh on how to guide the nation through what was going to be 7 years of tumultuous famine. Pharaoh listened to this man of God. The whole nation listened to this man of God. They followed his counsel and his advice. And as a result, when the famine struck the land, only Egypt was prepared for it. Only Egypt was ready for the famine. Even his homeland, Joseph's homeland, the land of Israel, where his father and his brothers were, was not spared the famine. It became so bad they could not eat. They were starving to death. They had to send emissaries to Egypt begging for mercy of some sort in order to find food, because Egypt was the only place you could find it. The rest of the world had been parched into oblivion. No food to be found. Cattle, plant life, rivers, streams, small lakes, all gone. Joseph could have been vindictive, but he wasn't. He brought his brothers in, at first unknown to them, and then later revealing himself to them. He loved them, he took care of them and their families, and they lived their lives under his protection and under his provision in peace and prosperity. Joseph is not unlike America's founding fathers, who led God's people to peace and prosperity in a strange land out of great upheaval. And as with Joseph, so with our founders, it cost them much personally. They too sacrificed much. Many of them lost everything: their homes, their lands, their businesses, their wealth, friends, reputation, and many of them their lives. Many of these men, their wives and children did not survive the war, nor did many of them. They were willing to sacrifice everything: their lives, their fortunes, their sacred honor, so that their posterity, you and me, could live in a land of peace and prosperity. The American dream historically has never been about money and wealth and cars and houses and 401k plans. That's never been the American dream, not historically. It's what the American dream has become to a bunch of self-centered, materialistic, selfish Americans. But in the beginning, that was not the dream. The dream was liberty. The dream was freedom. The dream was a land absent a King George dictating to them. It was a land where that they were free under God and under their own conscience to worship as they please. It was a dream where that men were able of their own accord to forge their own way in life, not to have government there to bail them out if they failed, but for government to get out of their way to let them be what they wanted to be. That was the American dream. They sacrificed, as did Joseph. Joseph not only illustrates the political fathers of this country, but even in a deeper way, the spiritual fathers of this country. As Joseph had a close and personal relationship with Egypt's Pharaoh, so too, America's black regiment pastors, a moniker given to them by the British Crown, by the way. They didn't call themselves that. That's what the British Crown called them, the black regiment. And that was because they usually wore long black robes to the pulpits on Sunday and thundered forth the messages of liberty and freedom and taught it from the Bible Sunday after Sunday, month after month, year after year. No wonder they were ready when the time came to fire the shot heard round the world on April 19, 1775, in Lexington Green, Massachusetts, as the British Crown was on their way to Concord to do two things. They were there to arrest John Hancock and Sam Adams, if they could find them, which Jonas Clark, Pastor Jonas Clark's men, some of them, about a dozen or so, protected those two men. And whenever they found out that the British were trying to arrest them, they actually took them away from the Lexington area as they were staying in Pastor Clark's home previous to that. And that was the intelligence that the British Crown had received, which caused them to march through Lexington on their way to Concord. And they took those men out of harm's way, and it was a group of Christian men from the Church of Lexington, Pastor Jonas Clark, that saved the lives of Sam Adams and John Hancock. And that's part of the history that you're never told in public or most private or Christian schools, unfortunately. Those courageous men, those preachers of colonial America, like Joseph, had a close personal relationship with America's political leaders. As I just told you, two of them were staying in Pastor Clark's home as the British were coming to Lexington and Concord. It was Jonas Clark's men in the church that took those two men under their guard and led them safely away from the area so they could continue to do the work they were doing in our war for independence. This was all before that shot was fired on April 19. Those men of God and those founding fathers knew each other well. They wrote letters back and forth often. They would visit in each other's homes. They would eat together. They would fellowship together. They were known on a first name basis with most of those founders who were in the process of drafting together the paperwork and the ideas that would form a new nation. It was the pastors who were giving the resolve spiritually, emotionally, mentally, intellectually, and so forth, in their hearts, what they would need when the moment came to issue that separation and to break free from the greatest military force and the greatest empire of the world at that time. It was the pastors who were the passionate voice. They were the voice of inspiration. They were the voice of moral high ground that the colonists needed when it came time to make the decision that they made and to do what they did. The relationship between the black regiment pastors of colonial America and the founders of colonial America was very similar to the relationship that Joseph had with the Pharaoh of Egypt. But Joseph in that generation died. And there arose a new king in Egypt. And this king, for all of his majesty and power, for all of his intelligence and military brilliance, for all of his wealth, for all of his charisma, for all of his charm, for all of his gifts, he knew not Joseph. He never met him. He didn't know him. He hadn't sat with him at supper. He hadn't spoken with him. He didn't know about Joseph's visions. He didn't know about the hand of God on his life. He didn't know about his love for the people of both Israel and Egypt. He didn't know about his vision of prosperity, his vision of protection and of provision. He didn't know about his vision of peace. He didn't have the benefit of knowing Joseph. You know what the problem among our civil magistrates in America today is? Most of them do not know a Joseph. Oh, they may know a preacher. They may know a pastor, of which most are nothing more than hirelings, not shepherds. They're like the prophets that sat at the table of King Ahab, who will say anything to ingratiate themselves unto the king's good will, who will say anything the king wants them to say, who will say anything the king wants to hear. They will say anything to keep their seat at the king's table. They're not prophets. They're not men of God. They're not Joseph. They're pandering, hireling servants of the king. And I don't mean King Jesus either. They don't know a Joseph. They don't know a man of God who really knows the Bible and has the courage to look them in the eye and tell them, "Thus saith the Lord." Most of the civil magistrates in this country, especially at the higher levels, do not know a Joseph. What happens when a king doesn't know a man of God? What happens when a nation's leader doesn't know a man of God? Look at verses 11, 13, and 14. Therefore they did set over them taskmasters to afflict them with their burdens. And they built for Pharaoh treasure cities, Pithom and Ramses. But the more they afflicted them, the more they multiplied and grew. And they were grieved because of the children of Israel. And the Egyptians made the children of Israel to serve with rigor. And they made their lives bitter with hard bondage, in mortar and brick, and in all manner of service in the field. All their service, wherein they made them serve, was with rigor. He took them into bondage and affliction and oppression and tyranny for 116 years. 116 years. Ladies and gentlemen, I knew what it was like to sit at the king's table. I was there. But I tell you, from the bottom of my heart, I don't know how to preach except to make the Word of God relevant and truthful to what is happening in our country today. My time left to speak and preach is very limited now. There's much more water under the bridge than what's yet to come. And I want you to know, as I contemplated many, many years ago this position that I was in and the future of my life, though very young then, making decisions that were going to last for the rest of my life, whether or not I would do what it took to stay seated at the king's table, or whether or not I would be true to my Lord and to my conscience and to my word and to the Lord's word, I remember very, very distinctly those thought processes and those decision processes back in my youth. And all I can tell you, the best way I think I know I can say it to you, I'm not just a Christian. And although the word Christian today can mean just about anything, so I'm not really sure what a Christian is anymore. I know what it's supposed to be. I'm not just a Christian. I am an American. And as such, the blood of Jonas Clark, John Witherspoon, John Leland, Joab Houghton, Peter Muhlenberg, and Ebenezer Baldwin flows in my veins. And I don't want a blood transfusion. Let me tell you a little bit about the pastorate of the man whose name I bear. According to one of his biographers, the pastorate of Mr. Baldwin covered those exciting years in the national history that preceded and marked the commencement of the Revolution. At that day, no class of citizens was more conspicuous for patriotism than the congregational clergy of New England. And among them, Mr. Baldwin was noted for his zeal and signal ability. Almost all of the writing for the public prints at that time was done by the clergy. In 1774, Mr. Baldwin prepared and published a spirited address to the people of the western part of the colony to arouse them to a sense of the danger in which their liberties were involved. In November 1775, on the day set apart for Thanksgiving in the colony of Connecticut, at a period when he regarded as the most calamitous the British colonies ever beheld, he preached a sermon designed to wake up the spirits of the people in the important struggle in which they were engaged. So excellent, encouraging, and appropriate was this sermon that it was called for and printed at the expense of a leading member of the Episcopal Church. A copy is preserved in the archives of the New York Historical Society. Mr. Baldwin, with the other ministers of the association, arranged a series of circular fasts in the churches of Fairfield County in the spring of 1776 on account of the threatening aspect of public affairs. Closed quote. If I'm going to have anything to do with it, when you hear the word Ebenezer, you think of Ebenezer Scrooge. I think of Ebenezer Baldwin. And if I have anything to do with it, old Ebenezer didn't die in vain. And he didn't work in vain. What did Pharaoh do? He burdened the people with heavy and grievous burdens. A quick history lesson. There has arisen in America, as I've said, leaders who knew not and know not our political and spiritual Josephs. When you go and look at the history of our country, there are a couple of significant years that changed for bad the course of our country. No year was worse than the year 1913. 1913 was a calamitous year for the freedoms and liberties of the American people. 1913 was a turning point year from which our country has not recovered. Many, if not most, of the problems that we are facing in America today, the abridgments and usurpations of our liberties that we are dealing with day by day, nationally and locally, directly result from what happened in that awful, awful year of 1913. Let me point out three significant events that happened in that year that illustrate what I'm saying. February 3rd, 1913. This is the date when the 16th Amendment was ratified and the direct income tax and the IRS were instituted. This was a flagrant repudiation of Jeffersonian principles of liberty. What began as a temporary measure to support the war of northern aggression became a permanent income revenue stream for an unconstitutional and ever-growing central government. And we are still dealing with that monster in 2016. April 8, 1913. This is the day when the 17th Amendment was ratified. This amendment overturned the power of the state legislatures to elect their own senators and replaced it with a direct popular vote. This was a serious blow against state autonomy and sovereignty. And today, the U.S. Senate, for all intents and purposes, is nothing more than a miniature presidency. The old constitutional system of the states electing their representatives to the Senate was annulled in 1913, and it is still the same today. And last but certainly not least, December 23rd, 1913. This is the day when the Federal Reserve Act was passed. This act placed oversight of America's financial matters into the hands of a cabal of private international bankers who have completely destroyed the constitutional principles of sound money and, for the most part, of free enterprise. No longer would the marketplace, private consumption, thrift, growth, etc., be the determinant of the U.S. economy, which is what freedom is all about, but now a private, unaccountable international banking cartel would have total power and authority to micromanage for their own private parochial purposes America's financial sector. Virtually every recession, depression, and downturn has been the direct result of the Fed's manipulation, again for its own purposes and with Washington's approbation and cooperation, of the market. Ever since, the American people have been saddled with incessant wars, crushing debt, a burgeoning police state, the destruction of homes, the deterioration of education, the gradual deafening silence of pulpits, the growing destruction of the middle class, and the loss of our liberties. But let me give you some things to ponder. I don't have to tell you that we are in a bad way in this country. I don't have to tell you generally, that things are not going well. All of the recent polling data from all of the most trusted polling research corporations are telling the American people that the vast majority of Americans from both sides of the political aisle, old and young, male and female, races notwithstanding, education notwithstanding, job placement notwithstanding, the vast majority of the American people say that our country is headed in the wrong direction. Democrats and Republicans, conservatives and liberals, they all say America is heading in the wrong direction. For the first time in a long time, the people that are graduating out of high school and especially college today are not optimistic about their economic future. For the first time since at least the end of World War II, the people that are coming up, the millennials that are going into the adult world, graduating from the various colleges and universities of our country, do not expect to enjoy as prosperous a lifestyle as did their parents. That has never been the case. Young people have always expected to do better than their parents economically and financially. They've always expected to live a better life materially than their parents. That is not the case today. I don't think we have to belabor it from a general perspective. America is not on a good course. It's not headed in a good direction. But let me give you three things specifically. And this is not making any predictions of any sort, just using history as a guide and modern examples of what's happening to give us food for thought. The only reason that America is a superpower, the only superpower since World War II, really has nothing to do with our military. The reason that we are the only superpower since World War II is because the dollar is the world's reserve currency. It's the only reason. The dollar is the world's reserve currency. And if you don't understand what that means, you could do just a little bit of research and you quickly discover why that's so important. Our country is pushing $20 million in debt, and that's the debt that they publish. When you add up all of the corporate and personal private debt, when you add up all the collective debt from all the various sectors of society, whether it's government, public debt, whether it's corporate debt, whether it's private debt or whatever, the total indebtedness of the people of America is well over $60 trillion. There is no other nation in the world that could sustain a $60 trillion debt and still have a modicum of prosperity. No other nation in the world can do that. And the only reason that we can is because the dollar is the world's reserve currency. In other words, the Fed control the printing presses. No other country can print themselves out of debt. No other nation in the world can do that. The dollar is the world's reserve currency, so the Feds alone are able to print, and print money to their heart's content to stave off what would be in any other nation a great depression and recession. And the only reason is because the world has to use the dollar for their international exchange currency. Every nation, when they do international financial transactions, they must convert their money, whatever it is, to dollars. And we reap the benefits of that through cheap goods at the ports of entry, the ships that are bringing goods to us, and the manner in which that we're able to stave off the results of indebtedness, with everybody forced to use, no exceptions, they must use U.S. dollars in their international trading. There are economists right now who are predicting that the dollar will be the world's reserve currency for only a little while longer. Russia and China and the rest of the world, for that matter, are fed up, sick to their stomachs with the arrogant Federal Reserve and the way that the feds are running over the countries of the world economically and cheating them legally for the benefit of the Federal Reserve system, using their capitalization of the dollar to do it. They're angry at us for a lot of things. They're angry at us for using our drones and our missiles and our aircraft to kill hundreds of thousands and yea millions of innocent men, women, and children all over the world. They're tired of it. They're tired of our arrogance. They're tired of our tyranny. They're tired of the way that we are killing at will those whoever leader we want to displace, and regime change here and regime change there, and then the guy that we take out, put in the other guy, then he becomes an enemy, and then we got to take him out, and in the process American lives are being lost, and we're beating the drum beats of patriotism and war all the time. And when you add what we're doing militarily around the world with what we're doing economically around the world, it is no wonder the world hates us. We brought it on ourselves. The Federal Reserve System and those politicians from both parties in Washington that support the Federal Reserve System are international gangsters. The American people should arrest them, put them on international trial in an international court, and put them in prison for the rest of their lives. What happens if the dollar is no longer the world's currency? We are going to see a depression that will make the 20s and 30s look like a Sunday school picnic in comparison. There will be no place to go, and there will be nothing safe. Savings will be wiped out. Jobs will be lost. Unemployment will be at an all-time high. Houses will be confiscated. Food will skyrocket in price. Gas will go up to at least $8 a gallon. You won't be able to afford a vehicle. The prices of everything will escalate exponentially. Soup lines will begin. Everything in our economy hinges on the dollar being the world's reserve currency. It didn't used to be that way. It used to depend on America's manufacturing. Our economy used to be free. We used to have free enterprise, free market. We manufactured stuff. We made stuff. We exported stuff. We made everything. We taught the world how to manufacture stuff. And now we manufacture hardly anything. Everything is imported. Everything is made offshore. We're not even making many of the parts that go to our jets and our ships of war. Our military apparatus is not even all of it made in the United States. Much of it is made in places like China. Can you imagine? If they ever really did want to go to war with us, I wonder what kind of parts we're going to be getting from them. Gee, I wonder why the plane won't take off. I'm not joining in with the chorus of the doomsdayers. I'm not saying that this is going to happen. Some of these economists are saying it's going to happen. Some economists are saying it's going to happen in a few days or a few months. Some of them are predicting really near-term doomsday scenarios. I'm not saying that. I don't know. And I don't really think they do either. But you don't have to be a trained economic scientist to look at the economic picture of our country just a little bit, just a little bit, and you know that we are teetering on a bubble that could go flat any moment. Add to that the U.S. and NATO fanning the flames of war all across the Middle East, Northern Africa, and now, as I've said recently, to Russia and Eastern Europe and even to China. Goading, goading, goading Mr. Putin into war. Setting up missiles on the borders of Russia. Can you imagine anything more provocative than building missile systems on the border of Russia? How would we react if Russia was building missile systems on the northern and southern borders of the United States? How would we react? And that's what we're doing to Russia. We're encroaching further and further into territorial waters of China. Our Navy, our Air Force is encroaching further and further into the airspace of Russia. Russia has for many years been preparing a civil defense program for the people of Russia. Bunkers, food supplies, medical supplies, etc., that even the Russian people are able to utilize in the event of a nuclear war. How many of the average Americans across this country have any preparation whatsoever in terms of a nuclear war? And our government is doing nothing to encourage the American people to prepare themselves for such an event. Oh, but don't worry, the president and members of Congress, they've got their own bunkers. They've got their own food supply and their own medical. They've got everything. It's just you and I that don't have anything. And there's not too many of us that can afford, like the rich people of America are doing now, the billionaires of America that are going all over the United States and they're building their own super bunkers in the event of a catastrophe of some sort. They've got the millions and millions of, there's millionaires in this valley that have built bunkers for themselves and for their families. But you can't afford that. I can't afford that. The media isn't telling us. They hide it from us. But we are closer to war with Russia today than at the hottest minute of the Cold War. The hottest minute of the Cold War was freezing compared to the moment that we live right now. I'm not making predictions. I'm not saying this is going. I don't know. I'm just looking at the honest signs on the horizon. Just like Joseph did when God gave him the vision that 7 years of famine were on the way. Get ready. You don't have to be a. You don't have to have a vision from heaven to see these things. And then add to that the all-out attempt taking place right now in our country, in our federal government, to ban our semi-automatic rifles. When you add up everything, and then you cap it all with they want to take away our means of self-defense. And let's be really frank here. If you do not own a semi-automatic AR-15 type rifle, you are defenseless. I don't care how many shotguns you own. I don't care how many bolt-action rifles you own. I don't care how many Glock pistols you own. If you do not own a semi-automatic rifle, you are defenseless. And if our community is not comprised of a high percentage of individuals, men and women, who have an AR-15 type rifle and know how to shoot them, that community is defenseless. And if a state does not have a high percentage of its citizens who own an AR-15 type rifle and know how to use it and the resolve to know how to use it, that state is defenseless. What I'm saying to you is when the AR-15 type semi-automatic rifle is taken from the American people, the American people are defenseless. And I say to you, Hillary Clinton and Michael Bloomberg and Dianne Feinstein and all the rest of you that think that you're just going to put something on a piece of paper, and those 5 million of us out here that I know about who own an AR-15 type rifle, a semi-automatic rifle, are just going to walk into the courthouse and surrender our means of self-defense to you, I will say to you what King Leonidas said to the Persian king out of Xerxes, Molon Labe! And I promise you there are millions of Americans across this country that are going to have the resolve to say the same thing. That's not the point. The point is they're trying to get them. The point is they want to ban them. The point is they want to make the people of America defenseless. Well, you know what? When you look at the economic tsunami that's coming around the corner, can you imagine soup lines? Can you imagine people without homes? Can you imagine people without jobs? Can you imagine people whose savings have all been wiped out in the bank? Can you imagine what's going to happen? Can you imagine what's going to happen when Russia and America go into a nuclear war? Yeah, if you can, you see that coming, and then you take away the means of the American people for self-defense, what you're doing, this is a design. This is a design to enslave us. If you haven't got our book, I'll be a book salesman right now. Tim and I wrote a book, To Keep or Not to Keep, Why Christians Should Not Give Up Their Guns. You can get it over here if you don't have it. You can go on the store online and get it. You've got to read this and let pastors read it and so forth and so on. And by the way, I mean, it gives me no pleasure to say all this. But if you're at a church where a pastor says from the pulpit, if the government tells you to surrender your gun, Romans 13 says you should surrender, so you should just all go surrender your guns, you are as much of a problem of what's going on as our country as any politician in Washington, D.C. Why are you staying in such a church? You're letting your pastor put the chains of tyranny around the necks of your children and your grandchildren. But you like the children's program. You like the Sunday school program. And they're putting chains around the necks of those children. And you're letting it happen. Giving your tithes and offerings there, attending there, supporting that church. And Christians all over America are supporting these churches who will not take a stand. In fact, they're encouraging their people to surrender their means of self-defense. Anybody who surrenders their means of self-defense, and we prove it in this book from the Word of God in both Testaments, has denied the Christian faith and is worse than an infidel. Any man that doesn't protect and provide for his own has denied the faith and he's worse than an infidel. And a part of providing for your own is protecting your own. How are you going to do that without the means of self-defense? And you're not going to do it with a shotgun or pistol. If you don't have an AR-15 type rifle, you are defenseless. Here's the way we ended the book. There may come a day when imbecilic politicians are able to successfully enact laws that rob Americans of rights we have enjoyed for centuries. That such a thing could happen should cause Christians to muster the courage demonstrated by our Christian forefathers like Abraham and Moses. And we go into all this in the book. You realize Abraham and Moses, before they became the great men of God that they eventually became, what did Abraham do before he was ever called or ever given a covenant or ever God raised? What did he do? He went to war with the kings of the east who had come and plundered his community and his province, had killed and stolen and taken his nephew Lot hostage along with other people. He took his personal servants, his trained fighting men of his own house, and he went after those kings, and the Bible says in the book of Hebrews, he slaughtered them, brought back the goods, and brought back the people. And as a result of that, after that, God called Abraham to be the man that he was. Same with Moses. What did Moses do before God gave him that burning bush experience and called him to go back to Egypt? What did he do? He killed the Egyptian taskmaster in defense of a Hebrew slave. And in Acts chapter 7, the deacon Stephen was very clear that the men of Israel didn't have enough sense to realize that Moses was raising up a standard for liberty right then, and if they would have followed him then, God would have given them freedom and liberty at that moment. But instead, they rejected Moses. They wouldn't accept his leadership. They quoted Romans 13. And Moses had to flee, and then God sent him back. Moses and Abraham, the two greatest men of the Old Testament, were men who believed in self-defense and who were not afraid to defend life when needed. That's why we refer to them. like Abraham and Moses, whose calling from God rested on their acts of defense. Christians should fortify their dedication to not let evil people fracture America by insisting that we give up liberty and rights because of their unreasonable and maniacal agenda. Christians should not permit these people to force dismay throughout the United States by turning fundamental right into government oversight. What Christians do in response during these days is crucial to the future success of America as a free nation. Last paragraph. If Christians do not become convicted about the most fundamental matter of our existence as God's creation, then perhaps no one will. But if Christians see the need for protecting and preserving life against criminal and tyrant, they will also see the importance in not surrendering their right of self-defense and thus their guns, of which the semi-automatic rifle stands supreme. Every pastor should read this. Every Christian should read this.
No, I don't need a semi-automatic rifle. I've got my shotgun. I've got my bolt action.
No, you don't understand. You don't understand. So the above is, who knows how long any of it will take to materialize. What I do know is this. The great constitutionalist Christian preachers and political leaders could almost be said to be of Joseph's generation. They're dying off. Name the great constitutionalist leaders. The ones that are left are mostly in their 60s and 70s, while many of them have already slipped into eternity. The Abrahams, Isaacs, Jacobs, and Josephs, that entire generation, if not totally gone, are mostly gone. America needs the Moseses to step up to the plate now. The 116 years of bondage required a Moses to step up to the Pharaoh. We need educators, physicians, attorneys, mayors, legislators, governors, sheriffs, businessmen, pastors, fathers and mothers, laborers, and Christians of every profession to stand up and say, as did Moses, let my people go. Joseph died, and all that generation, and there arose a king who knew not Joseph. And we've had nothing but leaders who know not Joseph for almost 116 years. God must prepare, and I think is preparing, a generation of Moseses somewhere in the wilderness right now. I'm talking to some Moseses. I may not live to see your contest with Pharaoh, but I'll be looking from up yonder, as will the rest of us. Those of us who made that decision a long time ago, that we would not sacrifice the message of truth to sit at the king's table. And we would not bow to the pharaohs of this world. And as we pass on, the tyranny of the kings who know not Joseph will only increase. And whether it comes through economic collapse or whether it comes through nuclear war, doesn't matter. Doesn't matter the mechanism. What's needed What's needed are Moseses to stand up in the face of the Pharaoh and say, "Let my people go." And I have enough faith in God to believe that whenever a Joseph dies, God has a Moses to take his place. Let it be you. Let it be us. Let it be those of you that are watching online across this country. May we be the Moses that our nation needs to take us out from the bondage and the tyranny of the Pharaohs who know not Joseph. Let's stand for prayer.